A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler-receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
We present Media Wars, Radio Propaganda Past and Present, a series of six programs produced and presented by Jonathan Marks. Episode 4, Let Governments Stick to Governing.
As we've seen so far in this series, credibility and balance are two very important factors to any international broadcasting station that wishes to reach an audience that will take it seriously. In general, history shows that stations operated by direct government control often make a mess of the message they're trying to put across. Either they assume that the listener is interested in streams of statistics, or they ignore the fact that in most cases the listener will tune around and compare broadcasts from different stations. But why do governments want to set up stations in the first place to broadcast to listeners overseas? Usually there are two main reasons. Either the government is dissatisfied with its independent external service, or it feels that a certain target audience is not being reached. To start with, let's take Britain as an example. Back on May 19, 1982, the British Ministry of Defence decided to requisition one of the BBC's transmitters on Ascension Island to broadcast the British point of view in the Falklands Malvinas conflict to Argentine troops on the islands, and so it created the station Radio Atlantico del Sur, Radio South Atlantic. It decided from the outset that programmes would not be produced by the BBC's Spanish service, but instead by Foreign Office personnel, and that programmes would not come from the BBC's headquarters at Bush House. But although it may have eased the British government's conscience to know that the British position was being presented to the Argentine troops, the chance of the intended audience being there in the first few days of transmission must have been somewhat slim, although it was designed to broadcast on a frequency not too far away on the dial from a commercial shortwave service coming from Argentina. The chances of Argentine troops moving their dial at the right time to the right spot in search of a British clandestine station must be rather small. After all, the censored Argentine press wasn't going to tell them about the new station, and Radio South Atlantic didn't help matters by playing a very short interval signal with long gaps in between, reducing the possibility that someone moving the dial at random might hit upon the station. But in fact, it's not the first time that the British government has decided to go into the broadcasting business. Back in the Suez Crisis of 1956, a commercial station on the Mediterranean island of Cyprus, Shark al-Adna, became the voice of the then Conservative government. The BBC had begun broadcasting to the Arab world in 1938, but at this time of the Anglo-French-Israeli incursion into Egypt, it was felt important to put the British standpoint forward to the Arabs. Shark al-Adna had been on the air since 1951, and although there had been some government control at its very inception, it wasn't until the 30th of October 1956 that the British Army decided to take it over completely. In doing so, the former Arabic staff decided to resign, since they didn't feel they wanted to broadcast anti-Nasser propaganda, and many of them had families in the target area. New staff were hastily recruited, and the station soon came on the air, broadcasting double the output of the BBC's Arabic service. But it had a very different message from that of the BBC. It didn't highlight the criticism the Conservative government was facing back in Britain because of its policy in the Middle East. The station's existence also affected the BBC, because, as in the case of the Falklands crisis, the Ministry of Defence requisitioned one of the BBC relay station transmitters, this time on Cyprus. In this case, the British government chose the powerful medium-wave relay, leaving the BBC to fend for itself on shortwave. And even after the ceasefire and the failure of the British policy, this voice of the British government continued on the air. It wasn't until March 1957 that it finally left the airwaves. But in the case of the Suez crisis, and also in the Falklands example, if the BBC is presenting the British viewpoint, doesn't this normally mean that it's also presenting the viewpoint of the British government? Gerard Mansell is a former managing director of the BBC's external services.
No, because it is accepted, and has always been accepted, that our function is to reflect the attitude of British public opinion, and that involves very often reflecting the fact that there is a national debate going on about particular major issues. Of course, the Suez operation was the most starkest example of that, and got the BBC, as you probably know, into a very great deal of trouble, because there was a major national debate, a national confrontation between those who were pro-Suez and those who were against it. And the BBC, quite properly and rightly at the time, right at the top, decided that since this was not a wartime situation, after all, the government itself had said this was a police operation, then its function was to reflect the fact that there was such a debate and to reflect both sides of the divide. This, as I said, caused a lot of trouble to the BBC, and its budget was reduced and all sorts of other punitive actions of this kind. But I think it's now recognised that, given the fact that the Suez operation gave Britain a very bad name, particularly in the Third World, not only in the Third World, the fact that the BBC revealed to the world at large that there was at least one half of the population of Britain which was violently and passionately opposed to the Suez operation was actually a contribution to restoring the good name of Britain in the world at large, and particularly in the Commonwealth.
Now, the Soviets have their particular voice of Soviet public opinion, radio station Peace and Progress. That's a very different kettle of fish, though.
Yes. I mean, one has to accept that the objectives of, as we were saying earlier, the objectives of the Soviet Union in broadcasting abroad are totally different from the British or Dutch or West German or even American objectives. They are frankly propagandistic because they are based on the ultimate truth of the Marxist ideology and on the principle that the revolution is marching towards a worldwide victory and that this is inevitable. This is the, and it must be assisted in this march by whatever means are available. So that this is essentially a tactical operation which is seeking to score advantages and score points at every turn. The kinds of things that are said in Amharic to Ethiopia, for instance, are different, I am sure, from what gets said to South Africa. They're not speaking with one voice, except that there is obviously a general assumption which is made in the broadcast that the Soviet Union is the friend of the underdeveloped, oppressed, exploited people of the world. This is a general line which is put out by Moscow, which is assumed in all the broadcasting to third world countries, which sometimes, of course, flies in the face of the facts, and often flies in the face of the facts, but is nonetheless what they are trying to put over. So this is a propaganda operation of the purest vintage.
In general, as far as shortwave broadcasting is concerned, the nearer your target, the stronger and more reliable your radio signal is. And this may be the reason why certain governments in exile have tried, and sometimes abandoned, shortwave radio as a form of propaganda. The militant, exiled Soviet anti-communist Popular Labour Union, whose initials in Russian are NTS, ran Radio Free Russia, starting in 1950 and lasting for over 20 years. It makes no attempt to disguise its espionage element, and today runs various underground newspapers. The group used to transmit in the early days from South Korea, Taiwan and even West Germany. But in later life they had studios and transmitters located solely in Bavaria, feeding shortwave parabolic antennas with a 45-degree beam. The station was jammed for all of its lifetime, and for that reason it used to shift its frequencies slightly in mid-broadcast to avoid the jammers. Imagine the problems of listening to that. Later, it seems, during the period of détente, the Soviet authorities brought pressure to bear upon the West German government and persuaded them to close the anti-Soviet operation by refusing them a renewal of the licence. Here's what the station sounded like, recorded in the Bavarian studio.
Говорит НТС. Да здравствует свобода! Внимание, внимание! Вы слушаете радиостанцию «Свободная Россия». Говорит НТС, Народно-трудовой союз российских солидаристов. «Свободная Россия».
Other governments in exile have also tried shortwave from a much longer distance between transmitter and target audience. Perhaps some of you remember Radio Euskadi, the voice of the Basque underground, which, according to the letter it used to send out to listeners, broadcast from the Pyrenees. There was even a picture of the so-called transmitter up in the mountains. Though if you looked very carefully, you could see that the picture of the transmitting tower had been superimposed on the mountains. In fact, that tower leaned slightly to one side, and had that antenna mast really existed, it would have fallen over with the slightest breath of wind. No, Radio Euskadi came not from the Pyrenees, but from a transmitting station just outside Caracas in Venezuela, and it sounded like this.
Eusko Erresistentziko gudarien deia.
This is Radio Euskadi, the voice of the Basque underground. Next follows a transmission in Spanish and Basque languages.
The programs were jammed by the then Spanish government, but it seems to have served its purpose in serving the Basque community with news, though any other clandestine freedom calls nowadays are likely to be heard on FM. Then there was Radio Free Portugal. Now this station operated for a while at the start of the 1970s from transmitters in Algeria, but then had its programmes put out from Romania. Well, the programme from that station used to attack the right-wing Portuguese government before the change of power, and were heard on various out-of-band shortwave frequencies, such as 8333 kHz and 9450. Curiously, though, the Communist Party living outside Portugal had a rival. This was the Patriotic National Liberation Front, a breakaway communist movement, which had its own airtime over Radio Algiers and called itself the Voice of Liberty. Here's an extract.
Esta é Voz da Liberdade, a Voz da Revolução, emissora do povo ao serviço do povo.
Spain, too, has been the target for broadcasts, apart from Radio Euskadi we've just mentioned. Radio Independent Spain transmitted for several years, until just after Franco's death, from Romania. And for a time, Radio Budapest also transmitted the same Spanish programmes. The station started in 1939, making it one of the oldest clandestines to exist so far. And when it operated, the Spanish government jammed it quite distinctly.
Radio España Independiente, Estación Federalta, la única emisora española sin censura de Francia.
The appearance of jamming on a particular signal is usually an indication that a government, in the target audience, is not too pleased with the programmes coming from over the border. This is the case today with the Soviet Union, which spends millions of dollars a year trying to prevent broadcasts from a number of Western countries reaching its population by setting up huge networks of jamming stations. Most of the effort is aimed at two stations operating from West Germany under the same roof in Munich, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, financed by the Americans. There's much documentation about these two radio stations and their audience. Indeed, both carry out regular surveys to judge their effectiveness. This is done by interviewing émigrés from the Eastern Bloc countries and asking them whether they've heard of Radio Free Europe or this one, Radio Liberty. Now let's go to the Middle East. Naturally, with all the oil there as a future energy source, some governments take note. Also, politics is somewhat unstable, to say the least, and with Egypt making its own deals with Israel, tensions mount. The Soviet Union has set up its own clandestine stations in the past to hit the audience in Iran. First came this station, Peki Iran. That broadcast came from Sofia in Bulgaria, and it was jammed by the Shah of Iran's government, who set up a transmitter which broadcast on the same frequency, continuous pop music, to drown out the Soviet finance station. The songs went round and round on a loop of tape, one of the jamming songs being Can't Buy Me Love by the Beatles, the other was Kiss Me, Honey, Honey, Kiss Me, a curious choice of titles. Also, the Soviets set up another station in Baku in the USSR, and during 1979 this encouraged all sorts of action to overthrow the Shah. When this happened, the Soviets cut the broadcasting hours. But since relations between Iran and the USSR have been more strained, so the station has been reactivated. At the moment, Asia is the main centre for what's called black propaganda stations. In other words, an organisation that starts up a radio station that pretends to be somebody else.
This is Radio Peking.
Well, if you're a regular shortwave listener, you'll no doubt have recognised that interval signal. But the Soviets have experimented with their version of Chinese broadcasting, not so much with Radio Peking, the external service, but with the Central People's Broadcasting stations that transmit to the domestic audience. By setting up powerful transmitters near the border, the Soviets are able to pick up the real Central People's Broadcasting station off the air. And for 10 minutes of the half-hour broadcast, they simply relay the real programme. But very soon they cut off the relay and then substitute their own commentary, which isn't so much pro-Soviet, but isn't exactly pro-Chinese either. The aim of the propaganda here is to sow seeds of dissent amongst the audience, by implying that the Peking government, so many thousands of kilometres away, doesn't really care what's going on in the outer provinces of China. The Chinese authorities, on the other hand, have retaliated by installing cable radio. And there's still an old clandestine around called Sparks, which pops up for very short broadcasts once or twice a week, always severely critical of the Peking government.
This is
and that identification at the beginning of the broadcast simply says, this is Sparks. It's jammed, and perhaps the thinking behind the short, repetitive broadcasts is that if the dedicated listener misses one particular transmission due to jamming, then perhaps there's a chance to hear the full message in a following broadcast. So far, there's one common theme with all these clandestine broadcasting stations. The group or government behind them hasn't come to power. But there are cases to be found where this is so, though whether the government came to power as a result of the broadcasts, or if the broadcasts simply acted as a supporting role, it's impossible to judge. Different sides tell, of course, different stories. Take the case of Liberation Radio, which many shortwave listeners around the world could hear back in 1974, being the voice of the South Vietnam Provisional Revolutionary Government, and designed to back the North Vietnamese in the war against the Americans and South Vietnamese, which raged until May 1975. The various theories as to where the transmitters were located. Some evidence makes it reasonable to assume that for some of the time, the Provisional Revolutionary Government, or the PRG for short, used five high-powered Chinese-built transmitters located in Kampuchea, or Cambodia, as it was then called. However, there's also reasonable evidence that some transmitters in Hanoi were used for the broadcasts as well. They did run English programs, and some others in foreign languages too. And they no doubt hoped that some of the American GIs were listening, though no medium wave outlet was ever monitored. A curious story emerged after the North Vietnamese won the war and renamed Saigon, of course, as Ho Chi Minh City. Someone in the old South Vietnamese capital thought it would be a good idea to show Western journalists how Liberation Radio had broadcast. A press official stated that Liberation Radio used to broadcast from the hills using mobile transmitters on what was then the North-South Vietnamese border. Later they said as the war had progressed, they'd moved their station south, nearer to Saigon. This was still in existence, and Western journalists were now invited to see this station, which had waged war against the imperialists. Well, the invitation was accepted by a number of interested journalists from Asia, and all went well until one Japanese gentleman spotted that the transmitter building they were being shown around obviously had no space for a modulator, the piece of equipment that's used to put the voice onto the transmissions. Indeed, it seems that the station the journalists were being shown around was nothing more than an old point-to-point station, which the South Vietnamese must have used to keep in touch with Saigon further south. An interesting but unrewarding public relations exercise. Well, let's listen now to how the station sounded.
We thank Liberation Radio, South Vietnam. South Vietnam, Liberation Radio.
That recording was taken off the air on 10.010 kHz, the frequency widely heard in Europe. But they also used 7470, 7490, and they also had a separate Vietnamese service on 7416 and 10220 kHz, all out of band. The station, of course, lasted until the Vietnam War ended. Media wars are also underway between the two parts of Korea, and also in Central America. Shortwave listeners in the United States were able to listen to Radio Sandino during the time of the Nicaraguan disturbances. Here's one of the final broadcasts on July the 18th, 1979.
Esta es Radio Sandino, voz de la liberación de Nicaragua.
Of course, audience figures for these clandestine stations are non-existent, and one can only speculate as to their effectiveness. The best information wars, though, are won by independent stations, trying as much as possible to present both sides of a conflict, admitting failures when they occur, and addressing the audience as human beings, rather than the enemy. Perhaps, fortunately, not many government-run stations have yet learned to do that.
In that episode of Media Wars, you heard the voice of Gerard Mansell and additional recordings supplied by Larry Magny and Jim Conrad. The program was produced by Jonathan Marks in the studios of Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. Some people get static. Some people get far-off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.